Ну что ж, это Львов на западе Украины. Это Донецк на востоке Украины.
С вами «Голос Новороссии», программа «На самом деле».
Харьков, Луганск, Донецк, Херсон.
Еще царских времен это Новороссия.
A country divided between a Ukrainian-speaking West and a Russian-speaking East. An irreconcilable schism forged in history and set in stone. Lviv versus Luhansk, orange versus blue. It's long been a truism that Ukraine was hopelessly split. It's a truism repeated endlessly by the Kremlin's propaganda machine, and one used by Vladimir Putin to justify his Novorossiya project. But it's a truism that the majority of Ukrainians' ethnic Russians in cities like Odessa and Mariupol in the south, to Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporizhia in the east, to Kharkiv in the north, are proving false. Most of Ukraine's ethnic Russians, it turns out, are loyal Ukrainian citizens. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in the studio here is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFURL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Welcome back, Natalia.
Hello, thank you.
And joining me on the Skype line from Sida, Turkey, is Andreas Umlan, a professor of Ukrainian and Russian history at Kiev Mohyla Academy. Welcome back, Andreas, and thanks for joining us during your vacation.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
It's great to have you. I want to get the ball rolling by citing some figures from a recent public opinion poll that was taken in the Kharkiv and Odessa oblasts, of course, two heavily Russian-speaking regions, because the numbers were pretty eye-popping. 87% of people in these two regions want to be part of Ukraine. Just 5% want to be either part of Russia or this mythical Novorossiya. 50% say their opinion of Russia got worse this year during the conflict. Just 3% said it got better. And 56% have a negative attitude towards Vladimir Putin. Just 18% have a positive attitude. These are the people that Putin is supposedly defending. And it seems they aren't interested. Natalia, these numbers would seem to suggest that Ukraine is much more united than previous conventional wisdom suggested, and that Ukraine's Russians are, in fact, loyal Ukrainian citizens. No?
Yeah, well, the people in the pre-war places like Kharkiv and especially in Dnipropetrovsk have seen what the not being loyal to Ukraine, or at least having the making this impression of not being loyal to Ukraine may cause in their daily life. And I think the myth of having pro-European Ukrainian-speaking West versus pro-Russian, Russian-speaking East is largely untrue. And this is why a lot of people are making this mistake while treating Ukraine. And I remember talking to very educated people somewhere in Italy and saying, why are you living in the same country? Why do you want to live with the same people who speak Russian? Why don't you divide it and be a much smaller country, more European size, a smaller European country, even if you don't have the access to the sea? Why don't you? Well, many countries don't. The Czech Republic doesn't. Other countries don't. You can still survive without. But they miss the point that the language of the issue of language and identity has been used and misused and abused in Ukraine for many, many years. But Ukrainians are much more united in issues of security, and I think security issues is number one now, and that's why it's become very, very clear cut. So the Russian-speaking Ukrainians want to be Ukrainian.
Right. And they want to be Europeans, apparently, because in other numbers that popped out in that poll, I don't have the figures directly in front. Actually, maybe I do. I think twice as many want Ukraine's future to be with Europe than want it to be with Russia. Another thing that blew my mind in that poll, 61% of Kharkiv and Odessa oblasts are bilingual.
Well, most of Ukrainians are bilingual, but 70%, and having said that, 70% of Ukrainians say that their native language is Ukrainian. So what that means that they still feel connected with the language and their identity and the country. And if they don't speak fluent Ukrainian, then their parents or grandparents spoke Ukrainian, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. they wanted it back. They wanted their identity back.
I guess what surprised me more was what the way the question was phrased. Do you speak Russian better or Ukrainian better or one or the other? And 61% said I speak both equally well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I lived in Odessa in the early 90s, and there were very few people that I don't know how they'd report in a poll, but I know when Ukrainian speaking friends would visit me from Kyiv, often emigres to the U.S. or to Canada who didn't speak any Russian,
mm-hmm.
they had trouble communicating with people because the locals in Odessa at that time didn't want to speak Ukrainian. I'm not sure which it was. I know my friends, the Ukrainian emigres who lived in Canada and the U.S. who were Ukrainian speakers, they couldn't speak Russian.
Right, right.
So, and I found myself in the absurd situation of
when
translating.
You had to
translating for
them.
But Andreas, what are your thoughts on this?
I think there is a misunderstanding both on the Russian side and also in the West about the divisions in Ukraine. And now, actually, these divisions have been even diminished by this war and by the perception also among many Russian-speaking Ukrainians who would have had a positive opinion of Vladimir Putin until a year ago, that this war is actually directed and supported by Russia. And this is now actually, oddly enough, a factor that is sort of becoming consensual among most Ukrainians, independently of their nationality and their native language or their preferred language. And even many ethnic Russians are now, who are Ukrainian citizens, are now becoming Ukrainian patriots in the full sense of the word.
Yeah, that's visible even on social media. I mean, I notice it watching Twitter feeds of people who are obviously Russian speakers. They tweet in Russian, but yet they're very pro-Ukrainian. I'm reminded of an IDP that I forget if it was from Donetsk or Luhansk Oblast, but came to Kyiv and was speaking to journalists, and he said, "I have a message for people in Russia. We'll never look at you as brothers again. We want no part of this."
Yeah, and in social media, people use Russian sometimes to make the point that they are Russian speaking, but they're pro-Ukrainian, so that the opponents on the other side, the Russian side, will understand that.
Now, one thing I wanted to drive at here, and I wanted to get both of your thoughts on this, is it's a little bit of the political geography of Ukraine. Why are places like Odessa, Dnipropetrovsk, Mariupol, Kharkiv, why are they different from Donbass? Is there something different? I mean, we know there's something different about Crimea. Crimea is a different case entirely. But what about Donbass? Is there something different about Donbass that makes it more receptive to what Russia's trying to do? Or is this all just Russian infiltration? And is this all just Russian manufactured? And they just happen to do it in those two oblasts because they're on the border.
I'm having in front of me research done by a group of Ukrainian visionary, interdisciplinary experts. And they say, called the Nestor Group. And they are trying to understand what's happening in Ukraine and how can the country move forward. And what they're trying to see is that first thing that I was mentioning previously about the security issues, about the values issues, which unite the country much more than the identity and language issue divides it. And they also say that based on institutions, Ukraine is conceived as an Eastern European country where the institutions are basically the same as in other former Soviet Union countries. But based on values, based on how the society is working within itself, they say that Ukraine is more like Southern Europe, except for two regions, which is Crimea and the Donbass.
Mm-hmm.
And there in Crimea and Donbass, you definitely see this desire for having a vertical structure of the society, of having the vertical власти, mm-hmm. the things that are going top down. And these are the people who mostly depended for their living on one, the living in small towns, has been organized around small factories, Soviet-style factories. So they don't really see themselves in having a lot of opportunities in their life. So this is a kind of paternalistic system and a paternalistic mindset where they really want to be a part of a bigger empire which will take care of them. This is a kind of Soviet serfdom system where the people were assigned a place to live, assigned a place to work, but in return they would get a minimum subsistence level of resources.
So it's economic more than
it is economic,
cultural, political.
Both, I think it's both, because in both those places, Ukrainians per se make in Donbass a small majority, but a minority in Crimea, and also the sociological structure of those regions was that there were a lot of immigrants from Russia. Well, people were sent to those places, especially in Donbass, where they after the Holodomor, after many people died in those areas, there were trainfuls of people sent from Russia directly, and they never actually became Ukrainians in that sense, in the political sense.
And this was isolated to Donbass, or is more prevalent in Donbass than
it was
elsewhere?
More prevalent in Donbass because these were the industrial area, and they were brought to this place, given a job at that factory or that mine, and that was their life.
Mm. Andreas, anything you'd like to add here? I mean, what is different between cities like Odessa, Dnipropetrovsk, Mariupol, Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, on one hand, and the Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk on the other?
Yes, I think I just want to start with maybe saying that one should also distinguish between Crimea and the Donbass, because on Crimea we have both in demographic terms and sociological terms a slightly different situation, in that on Crimea indeed there is a majority of ethnic Russians, and there was support in various opinion polls for secession and even annexation to Russia that, according to the polls that I remember, was between 40% and 60%. Mm-hmm. So there was indeed there about half of the population actually wanted Crimea to become a part of Russia, but the other half not. I mean, that's the other point to be made here. I mean, and certainly not the Crimean Tatars. With the Donbass, according to the polls that I remember, there is about a third of the population that wants either secession from Ukraine and joining Russia, or secession from Ukraine and creating an independent state. So that's already somewhat less than on Crimea, and that's exactly the problem that Russia has encountered now, that there is some grassroots support for secession and even for annexation to Russia, but it's not a majority. It's not even half of the population as in Crimea, and therefore there is a special situation, also a distinct situation in the Donbass, distinct from the Crimean situation.
Mm. I'll just make it very short.
Natalia wanted to jump in here. I'll come back to you, Andreas.
Intervention about the polls that Andreas was quoting. The polls that he mentioned were done already in the last months of Maidan, and then when the situation was already very heated, the propaganda was going full steam. Ukrainian media were not reaching those areas, while Russians were working really very hard on changing the opinion of the people. If you take the polls from the so-called peaceful time from May last year, you will see that there were less than 10% of people who in Crimea, and I would like to stress in Crimea, wanted to join Russia.
Less than 10%?
Yeah.
Interesting. Andreas, finish. I know you wanted to finish there, so I'm going to go back to you now.
No, I mean, frankly, this 10% seems to me a bit low. I mean, I don't have these polls now in front of me, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I remember older polls where there was a significant part of the population, obviously ethnic Russians, mainly who were in favor of secession and even annexation. And but still, that leaves, I mean, what do you do with the other half of the population, the ethnic Ukrainians, the ethnic Russians who were not in favor of that, and especially of the Crimean Tatars.
Tatars, of course.
In the Donbas, indeed, there is the support has always been much less, and there's no Russian ethnic majority there, and that's now exactly, I think, the reason for the war there, that you couldn't stage something like that, like in Crimea in the Donbas, because simply the support is not there. And I remember a statement by Girkin, who was for a while and still is to a certain degree the leader of the military organizer of the Donetsk Republic, who was complaining that he couldn't find enough volunteers among the local Ukrainian population to fight the war actually against Kiev. And So that's exactly the reason for Russia's involvement there.
So they had a minimal level of a critical mass in Donbass, and they were able to do it. But in places
and
like...
And I doubt even... I really doubt even about Crimea if they were given a choice, because in the elections still in Ukraine, the leader of... the present leader of Crimea, Mr. Aksionov, he got... who went to the polls with a really pro-Russian agenda, he got less than he was getting low single-digit numbers of support, and then he became a leader of the whole of the whole peninsula. Yeah. How come?
Yeah, because Moscow anointed him. That's why. The other thing, if you think of what is it about, like, Odessa? Odessa fought back. I mean, Odessa fought back when they tried to pull this in Odessa. Mariupol fought back. There's something. Not only are Russians in these Russian speakers, ethnic Russians or Russian speakers who are Ukrainian citizens, not only were they not willing to join the pro-Moscow insurgency, they fought against it. What is it about these places? Odessa, Dnipropetrovsk, Mariupol. I mean, you saw a resistance in Odessa and Mariupol specifically, but you saw zero enthusiasm in Dnipropetrovsk, Zaporizhia. Kharkiv surprised me. Mm-hmm. Kharkiv is the one in that group that surprised me. But what is it about these cities let's look at it from the other side. Like, what is it special about these cities that...
I really think that the first and foremost was after the insurgents in or the separatist movement or the Russian intervention or all of that.
All of the above.
All of the above happened in the in Donbass. People realized that their security is an issue number one. And then I think Dnipropetrovsk is especially important in that sense, because it's the pre-war, pre-front area, and people go to the war and come back to, home within an hour or two. So that's being very, very close. They see what the situation is there. So it's being the proximity really makes sense and makes it very important. Odessa is another place. Odessa is seen as a free city, has always been. And Odessa is a very mixed city, ethnically and linguistically and culturally and all of that. And they don't want to be reduced to being a Russian-speaking minority or majority in a place where they can't express what they want in Russia. Mm-hmm. The thing is, in Ukraine, they can express what they want, whether they are satisfied or dissatisfied. Now they say that the only place where people can openly speak their mind in Russian, the best place is probably Ukraine.
Yeah, no, in Odessa, the happiest year of my life was the year I spent in Odessa, and I'm recalling very early in the conflict when the Russian propaganda was filled with talk of these banderovtsi that were doing everything. And I don't know if you saw this, Natalia or Andres, this wonderful video that was, because Odessa, you know, of course, is known for its humor. They produced this wonderful video where these guys walked around Odessa and said, "Look, there's nobody at the bankomat. The banderovtsi must have taken all the money." They go to the McDonald's. They said, "There's no children in the McDonald's. The banderovtsi must have eaten them all." You know, it just went on and on to the level of absurdity, but it was hilarious. Andreas, anything to add about these cities? What's special? I mean, Kharkiv surprised the hell out of me, to be honest. Yes. I expected Kharkiv to be more trouble.
My suspicion, I haven't yet seen enough research on that, but my suspicion is that indeed there is, as Natalia indicated, there is not just an issue here about the ethno-linguistic sense of identity, but also a choice between the systems. And there might be the rejection that the sort of separatism or pro-Russian secessionism has encountered in Kharkiv, Dnipropetrovsk, and Odessa may have to do more with the fact that that would be an annexation then towards Putin's Russia and not towards Russia per se, and that it would be an annexation towards a sort of isolationist, bizarre country that that has you know, an anachronistic political system and so on. And the And that's obviously not a big issue for the older generation. They come from the Soviet system, but I think for the active young people, I think it's less so that Russia is something to be rejected as such, but it's Putin's Russia. It's the idea of getting back into some sort of neo-Soviet or para-Soviet system with where the state tells you how to live and what to do. And I think my feeling is that many people in the south and east of Ukraine, they have a sort of a fluid identity. They could perhaps be also part of a larger Slavic or Russian world if that were a different Russian or Slavic world, if that would be a freer place and where economic and political and civic freedoms would be guaranteed, then there would be no problem with that. But the problem here is actually Putin himself and the system he has created over the last 15 years. And the young people, the active ones, they know about this difference, and they may have been to Europe. They know what Poland and Slovakia and Bulgaria and all these countries that are also ethno-linguistically close to the Ukrainians have gone through, and they want to do want to go this path rather than the Russian Eurasian part, or however you want to call it.
Mm-hmm. No, and I keep coming back to Odessa. I mean, living in Odessa in the early 90s, people did have very warm, positive feelings towards Russia. That's for sure. But it was the Russia of the early 90s. It was the Russia of the Gaidar reforms. It was the Russia that appeared at the time to be turning west. But at the same time, people were very excited about being part of this new country they just inherited called Ukraine. And so they really had this dual feeling. So I guess it makes sense, Andreas, what you were saying here is where, you know, it's a rejection of Putin's Russia. If it were a different Russia, although I'm not sure right now we're gonna see that different Russia for a long time, maybe they would have different feelings. But then this wouldn't be an issue because a different kind of Russia wouldn't be trying to annex part of Ukraine. Right?
Well, the expectation in Odessa, as you're saying, in the beginning of '90s was one kind of Russia, and the expectation in Donetsk and Donbass region of present Russia is again a different expectation. Mm-hmm. They expected it to be a Soviet Union, and Russia is not a Soviet Union anymore. So they are now up to a big disappointment because they see not exactly what they wanted to see. So these are the different expectations from different people in different parts of Ukraine.
Right. Okay, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of Ukraine's ethnic Russians and look to the future and what role they might play in the new Ukraine that will emerge from this conflict. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFERL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. And joining me on the Skype line from Sida, Turkey, is Andreas Umland, a professor of Ukrainian and Russian history at Kyiv Mohyla Academy. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Сегодня Львов заговорил на русском, а в Донецке слышен украинский.
Давайте Украина, не она неоднородная территория.
Нужно делать
она
две была... Украины, пора разделяться.
А Запад Донбасс... Украины с огромной радостью отделится от
Восток
восточного.
Восток неподъемный балласт.
Я который... желаю раздела Украины.
In just a week's time, Ukrainians will go to the polls to elect a new parliament, and it will be a different electoral map than the one we'd become accustomed to in previous parliamentary elections. And when the dust from this conflict finally settles, it's going to be a different Ukraine than the one we've become accustomed to. Natalia, of course, regional differences will continue, as is the case in any country. But if the old all-encompassing orange-blue divide that we used to use to define Ukrainian politics, I mean, you look at the map after any election, if this is really a thing of the past, what's going to replace it?
Well, I think that the last elections, which were won on that that map, were Yanukovych and the Yushchenko elections, and all the other elections before and after, they showed the slow movement of so-called Western values across the Ukrainian map, even slightly towards Crimea and Donbas. So these areas are now going to be isolated. There are not going to be elections in Crimea, full stop. The Ukrainian they are not included in the electoral process, and in Donbas it's going to be highly questionable how they're going to organize it. Again, the security issue is the most important. But in the sense of values, I think areas like Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporizhia are not going to be very much different from Zhytomyr and Khmelnytsky. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a huge... basically, we're going to see what we already know, that this is becoming core Ukraine in the sense that these values are going to be there and very much alive, as much as in the western part of the central part of the country.
So we're going to see kind of what we used to think of as Western Ukrainian values kind of sweeping
we'll see
south and east.
Yeah, south and east. We saw this division very, very, very interesting and very slow. There was in 1991 the areas which were staunchly pro-Ukrainian were only the three Western Ukrainian oblasts, and then with the pass of time, the center, the rest of the Western Ukraine and the center joined, and now the east and the south joined. Mm-hmm. So these are the Ukrainian project is moving, and it's winning more and more hearts and minds in Ukraine.
Andreas, what do you think?
Yes, indeed. There was a slow movement over the last 20 years towards a sort of Europeanization, one could say, of Ukraine. But I think this year now is actually, it really is, there's a jump. It's not just a slow continuation of an earlier trend. But we saw that already in the presidential elections. Poroshenko was able to collect at least a relative majority in all macro regions of Ukraine and a relative majority in almost all electoral districts. And that was already something quite extraordinary in the first round. And as it looks now from the polls, the competition is mainly taking place between different, more or less pro-Western parties, even such a bizarre party like the radical party of Oleh Ljashko, at least officially, says that it is pro-European and pro-democratic and so on. And so the competition is now actually taking place, paradoxically, between parties that are difficult to distinguish in ideological terms between each other, the Yatsenyuk Front, the Poroshenko bloc, the Batkivshina party, they all look rather similar and are competing for the electorate. And apparently the sort of classically pro-Russian parties, they will only be a minority. And some of them may not even make it to the Verkhovna Rada, or at least not in the proportional part of the voting.
Well, in this sense, I mean, we could say Ukraine's becoming European here, because basically that's, I mean, okay, all of these parties agree on the very big issues, which are no-brainers in whatever Poland or Bulgaria or the Czech Republic or Slovakia, that, yeah, this country should be independent and shouldn't be part of another country, right? And we should adhere to basic democratic values. All parties that are going to get into parliament are going to basically, where this wasn't the case in the past. This just wasn't the case in the past. So in this sense, there's going to be the normal ideological divisions of left and right that we have in normal regional divisions over dividing of the spoils. But about these big macro issues, these aren't going to be on the table anymore, which is going to, another way, Natalia, that's making Ukraine more European, right?
I'm not sure that we are going to see the maturing of the Ukrainian political elite so fast, because it lags very significantly behind the society, and especially behind the civil society of Ukraine. And but having said that, I really see that this language divide is going to be a thing of the past. The identity divide is going to be the thing of the past. People are really concentrating on the security-based agenda, and this is the physical survival, the education, the social ladder, the opportunities, work, ethics, entrepreneurship, and private initiative, and things like that, which are really things which unite East and West and North and South of the country. And frankly speaking, when we have the Maidan movement, and everyone was talking about these issues about in Maidan. No one, very few people were talking about the language and the identity issues and the ethnicity issues in Maidan, because there were lots of Russian speakers and really lots of people from all over Ukraine. So the expectation and my expectation, personal expectation, was that these things are so important to the east of the country, especially because they were in a much worse situation than they're much more exploited. Much less opportunities, much worse served by the state. That these would be the issues that would people would understand and support Maidan. But instead, we saw the how the propaganda changed, completely changed the agenda, and they started to fight for ethnicity and and the language and things like that.
Even though Maidan itself was bilingual. I mean, you heard as much Russian coming off the Maidan as you heard Ukrainian. Well, we brought up language, and it is one of the things I want to talk about, because in this new Ukraine that is emerging, do you think there's room for compromise in the language issue? Do you think Russian could become a state language, for example? Is this such a hot-button issue among Ukrainian speakers in the West, or would they be willing to compromise? In the clip at the very start of this podcast, and this is something that seems almost like from another world now, where like to show unity for a day, Lviv spoke Russian and Donetsk spoke Ukrainian. This was right before all the trouble started. But do you think there's maybe room for compromise in the language now?
Well, I don't think that there is a need for the compromise with the Russian speakers. They can use their language without any problems. And I think the usage of the Russian language is much wider, and especially the things that you can express in the Russian language in Ukraine. The range of issues is much wider. So I don't really think that this would be an issue.
I mean, in terms of as another state language, is this something that might be considered? Or because to me, looking at it from an outsider, it looks like something that could be almost symbolic, that would go a long way towards generating more goodwill and making the Russian speakers feel more included. And it really wouldn't cost anything. Now, I understand that people feel very strongly about this issue on both sides, but it seems to me it's something that could be given that would make the rest feel more included.
Well, the ways the Russian language is used now, it has much more opportunities than the Ukrainian language. The print press is much bigger in Russian. The television programs, you have more television programs in Russian. So the only way that Ukrainian language is still the state language is the language of the documents of the state. So if that is a very big problem for the Russian for the Russian speakers, I don't see them from the Russian speakers themselves. Uh-huh. They don't bring this issue anymore, or at least what I have seen and talked to the people that I know about that.
Andreas, what do you think?
Well, I think the issue is indeed an artificial one. Until 2012, Ukrainian was the only official state language. Then we had this law introduced by Kibalov and Kolesnichenko in 2012, which established Russia as a regional language for the eastern and southern regions. But my impression is that this change in legislation has actually not changed that much in terms of the practical life of the people. Mm-hmm. So I was asking my students in Kiev, whether those who came from eastern and southern Ukraine, whether they were taught in school and in university in Ukrainian, as it should have been, and until 2012, when Ukrainian was the only official state language. And they said, yes, officially, yes, but in fact, not really. And And that was always the case, that there was this officially announced Ukrainian language, and but in fact the Russian was used widely and even predominantly in many regions of Ukraine, and so that wasn't an issue. For the future, I think my feeling is that probably a modified language law that will in some sense remind of the Kolesnichenko Kivalov law will be adopted, and perhaps there will be some regulation for regional languages, and then in some sense it could be said that Russian will be then a second state language. But I don't think it will be really introduced in the constitution as an official second state language. There's now also just a tradition of having Ukrainian as the only state language, and it hasn't been really a problem until recently, and therefore, I don't think there will be a fundamental change here.
So neither of you think really that this is a non-issue in the new Ukraine, really?
In the past, it was the language was a signal of your social status, of even a colonial status towards the Ukrainians there. And I don't think that the Russians are now associated this way. So there is no status issue anymore attached to the language.
Okay, that's another thing I wanted to touch on is the role of the Donbass oligarchs, the Akhmetov question, right? Because
that's a many million dollars question.
it is a many, 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 many million dollars question. But what about them now? What role are they? Because they were a powerhouse in the old Ukraine, and the Donbass was their base. Well, the Donbass is decimated, and the Donbass isn't, for the time being, isn't part of this new Ukraine, and we don't know where this is going to go. I'm expecting the conflict to be frozen, is what I'm expecting, and that means that it's going to be kind of a Georgia situation where this is going to be on the outside. What about Akhmetov and the Donbass oligarchs? What role do they play? Do they play a constructive role?
Well, most people see now the situation as moving towards the frozen conflict. But the question, the number one question for Ukraine is how this frozen conflict is going to be, or the territory of the frozen conflict is going to be financed. Who is going to pay for it? If it's going to be paid from the Ukrainian budget, paying for the people who they don't control, or it's going to be paid from the Russian budget, or it's going to be supported by the international community. And of course, the biggest question then is what's going to happen to the industries of those oligarchs, because so far they have been seen from the both sides. In areas like Dnipropetrovsk, the local oligarch took side with Ukraine, and we see what happened with Dnipropetrovsk. And in Donbass, we didn't see the same thing happening.
Akhmetov was sitting on the fence the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
What? But do these people continue to be okay? The some will be players. Will they be players in the new political game? And if so, how?
Well, they put their eggs in many different baskets. So we'll see where the concentration of eggs will be.
Okay, Andreas, what are your thoughts on this?
There is a big mystery, actually, especially about the Donbass, which used to be seen as Akhmetov territory.
Right.
There used to be a sort of consensus that the Donbass is unofficially, at least, controlled by Akhmetov, that everything is the party of regions, the state institutions, the businesses, the criminal world are all sort of under Akhmetov's control, or directly, indirectly. And now it has turned out in the recent months that this is actually not the case, and that this insurgency in the Donbass was apparently not organized by Akhmetov, who should have had the resources to do something. And that's also an indication that there was probably another player, because people like Ponomarev or Girkin or Borodai and all these strange leaders of the Donbass insurgency, they do not have a local constituency, and they came sort of out of nowhere. And the Party of Regions and Akhmetov and all these formal and informal structures that the that the Akhmetov clan had created in the Donbas suddenly didn't play any role anymore. So this is still to be researched, and it will be very interesting to see how this all played out. And it will be also interesting to see how this all will play out in the future, because, of course, most of the property in the Donbas belongs to people like Akhmetov. And what is going to happen when these so-called People's Republics are going to continue to exist and expropriate this, or how are the Akhmetovs and all the others are going to position themselves towards this? That is going to be a rather interesting story.
Yeah, no, he is physically in Kyiv right now, if I'm not mistaken, right? Or is he? Where is he physically? I'm sure he's not in the Donbas.
Well, yes, that's what I've heard.
Yeah, but the thing is that many people wonder how come that the bombs and shelling is going all around the place, but not a single bomb was got into any of his property, any of his real estate.
All right, no. So this is something to watch, because there are going to be oligarchs. They're even in the new European Ukraine, there are going to be oligarchs. It's just which ones and how are they going to behave? Before we wrap up, I wanted to touch on one last thing. We're going to circle back to Russia, since this is supposed to be a podcast about Russia, but it's been about the Russians of Ukraine. Ukraine's moving west. I don't have any doubt about that. Not one. And I've said this in every opportunity I've had. Ukraine's moving west. The only question is how fast and how many more innocent people have to die before they get there. When Ukraine gets west, what's that going to do to Russia, which traces its civilization to Kyiv, and which feels this tight bond with Ukraine? It's often a painful bond for Ukraine, but it's nevertheless a tight bond that's felt in Russia. What will that example do to Russia? Because this is going to happen, and it's going to have resonance in Russia. Andreas, what do you think? You research both Ukrainian and Russian history. What is your sense psychologically? What's this, and politically, what's this going to do to Russia?
Well, I mean, that's exactly the problem, the issue, and in my view, the reason that Russia is so much engaged in Ukraine, because the leadership of Russia is fearing that there might be an alternative model of development appearing with which many Russians could come to associate themselves. That's why Russia is trying to discredit the Ukrainian government. That's why we have all this anti-Westernism, now also anti-Europeanism. That wasn't the case until a few years ago. The anti-Westernism in Russia was mainly anti-American, but now it's also turning against the European Union. And that's exactly the problem that the Kremlin has, that with the successful Europeanization and modernization of Ukraine, this would immediately then become a sort of role model also for many Ukrainians, because the distance, the geographical distance, and also the cultural distance is not that large, and the ties are manifold. And that's exactly why Putin is now trying to discredit the government and also to spoil the business climate, the investment climate in Ukraine. What he wants, in fact, is the Ukrainian experiment, if we want to call it that way, to fail, because that would then destabilize his own regime. That has not much to do with Russian national interests. It has more to do with the private interests of the current Kremlin leadership. The problem here is, of course, that he's now also touching the interests of the West, of the European Union in particular, which does not need a large failed state on its eastern borders. Imagine a situation where Ukraine follows a sort of Yugoslav scenario, and then you would have millions and millions of refugees who would be coming to Eastern Europe. That touches, or to Western Europe as well, that touches core interests of the European Union. And I think that's why this is a miscalculation on the side of the Kremlin, that the European Union will simply let Ukraine be a prey to Russia and destabilize and destruct, because the European Union has very egotistic its interests in Ukraine. It needs a stable Ukrainian state for its own security.
Yeah, no, and if you read the Russian press, there's a lot, there's this kind of overconfidence at the West's short attention span, and there certainly is a short attention span in the West. It's just so many distractions. But we're going to forget about Ukraine sooner or later. We might be all riled up about it now, and there's sanctions and whatnot, but sooner or later we're going to get tired of this, and things will go back to normal, and Putin will be able to do whatever he wants. But Andreas, I think you're right, because it's not just Poland, first, and Lithuania, first of all, who are support. There are real material interests that Europe has here, and it certainly isn't some American plot. but there's real serious interest that Europe has here, and the attention span is not going to go away, I don't think. Natalia, your thoughts?
It's not only the negative sides of the question; it's also the possible benefits of having Ukraine in the club of economically prosperous and stable countries, because of exactly the same things that we were discussing, the economic, social, political links to the Russians, because they are the best people to provide this link with Europe, and to bridge those ideas from Europe to Russia. And I think this is one of the biggest fears of the Russian regime, because what they're now trying to do is to isolate Russia from the world and from Ukraine too, because Ukrainian means freedom now. Ukrainian means freedom in all post-Soviet states, from Russia to Azerbaijan to the republics of Central Asia. So this is a new virus they don't want to spread.
Do you think that Ukraine could provide a positive, that this could resonate in Russia and maybe nudge Russia in the Western direction eventually?
It's a big question whether Putin will put all his force against for trying to destabilize Ukraine and not to make it succeed in any direction, because we can see now the gas issues, the not only the military issues, the economic issues and all of that. And then there are thousands of questions about Russia. What is going to happen to the Russians after the pendulum of the Russian public opinion gets back, and they see what the real situation is, because now they're being pumped with propaganda, so to the extent that 59% of Russians think that the sanctions and the self-imposed sanctions of the Russians are beneficial to the country.
It's
a real big question what will happen when the Russian opinions, when the Russians will sober up.
Okay, well, when the Russians will sober up, I can think of no better way to wrap it up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio has been Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFRL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. And joining me on the Skype line from Sida, Turkey, has been Andreas Umland, professor of Ukrainian and Russian history at Kyiv Mohyla University. Thank you both for the enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.